This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed to New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perrault.
Well, it's very nice to have you with us for another edition of the program. This past week, North Korea has been in the news again, this time making nuclear threats against the United States and South Korea and, of course, Japan. It has to do with the starting up again of a plant that was originally destroyed a number of years ago. But the North Koreans have, well, effectively rebuilt the plant and say that they have enough plutonium to put into a warhead. Now, this, of course, is information that is being reported on by North Korean media. So there's no independent way to really verify this information. Now, North Korea is a state that is starved for information. Its people will go to extraordinary lengths, when they can, to listen to foreign broadcasts. Now, this, of course, is a very dangerous thing. Either they can get arrested, pay a hefty fine, or in some extreme cases, even be sentenced to death. But nevertheless, North Koreans still make an attempt to listen to the wide variety of freedom stations from South Korea, including Radio Free Asia, the Voice of America, and others. One of the more popular stations from South Korea that broadcasts into the North on shortwave is Open Radio North Korea. Hi Tak Kong is their president.
광장 희망의 소리 열린북한 방송입니다. 열린북한 방송은 남북 해외의 한민족이 함께 만들어가는 참여 방송 공동체 방송입니다. 북한의 형제들과 대화하고 싶은 사람은
The main purpose of my organization is to promote information flow in and out of North Korea. So for the information in process, we broadcast radio programs toward North Korean people. And for the information out of North Korea. We have a network, personal network inside North Korea, who report what's happening inside North Korea to the outside world. So that's why we are running the webpage in Korean, both in Korean and in English, to report the internal North Korean news.
That must be very challenging. I mean, how do you get information outside North Korea? I mean, it's the most secretive country in the world.
It's quite secret compared to other countries in the world. But actually, since about 10 years ago, the control of the regime over North Korean people get weakened. So, especially in the border area, the Chinese-North Korean border area, more and more people are using Chinese cell phones because, you know, the signals of Chinese cell phones can reach the border area of North Korea either because, you know, the border doesn't know the barrier of the electric signal. In my office, we call the people in North Korea where they live in the border, Chinese-Russian border. That's one way we contact them. And the other way is we meet them in China as they come out of North Korea, pretty high-ranking personnel. That's the other way how we contact North Korean people and get information from them.
It must be a very difficult job because you're you're contacting people that are coming from a place that is very repressive. I mean, do you have a fear in the back of your head that sometimes that the people that are passing along information, their lives or their families could be at risk?
Exactly, yes. It's very risky process. So we are very, very careful about, you know, when and how contact them. We don't freely call them, you know. We set times of when, what time we talk to each other, and then North Koreans give us signals, then we call them. And North Koreans, when they call us, they try to find a pretty safe place where they make a call.
Mm-hmm.
Then the time of talking to each other is not long, you know, less than a few minutes. And then look around and we try to make a call. So it's pretty secret and careful.
Now, with your programs that you're putting together, I mean, it has been done in the past when, let's say, during the Cold War period, either targeted towards the Soviet Union or even at China at one point. Broadcasters that, let's say, wanted to reach the audience, what they would do is they would hire, let's say, either Soviets or Chinese that had left those countries and try to make the program sound as if they were coming from within the country itself. Do you do that as well? I mean, my question is, do you have North Koreans on staff, and do you try to make the program sound as if people may think that they're coming from the central broadcasting system?
You know, we say them, we broadcast from Seoul, Korea. We don't pretend to broadcast within North Korea. We don't do that. It is not fact. We don't make up a propaganda type program. We don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's journalistic programs.
The announcers that you have on air, are they North Koreans themselves?
We have some of my full-time staffers are North Korean people who defected to South Korea. Yeah, so they have North Korean accent.
Now, with the programs that you're doing, how are you reaching North Korea? Are you using medium wave? Are you using FM? Or are you using shortwave?
Yeah, we have two shortwave hours program. And we have 1 hour AM and the other 1 hour FM.
Mm-hmm.
All 4 hours a day.
Now, with those programs that you're doing, it must happen quite often that the North Koreans try to jam either the shortwave or AM signals, yes?
They tend to jam in the early period of our broadcast, in 2005 and 2006. But nowadays, they don't jam at all. I think the reason is because of the shortage of the electricity. You know, as you know, North Korea suffers from energy issues. So at night, you know, only the Kim Il-sung's statue is shining. The other area is just pretty dark. So they suffer from a very serious shortage of electricity. I think it influenced on jamming as well. So jamming costs a lot of energy.
They're probably just not bothering anymore, is what you're saying.
Yeah, especially to us, because there are several radio programs to North Korea. My program is not, as I said, is not very propagandistic type. So some type of radio programs are jammed
mm-hmm.
in the North Korean region, but not us.
One final question. What about the funding for Open Radio North Korea? Is it mostly done from private donations?
It is mostly from abroad, not within South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
United States, Europe, and Japan. Private foundation, for example, in the United States, National Endowment for Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, Reporters Without Borders, and some fund, about 80% of funds come from outside, about 20% of our fund, you know, come within South Korea.
That was Hai Tae-kong, the president of Open Radio, North Korea. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, reduce speed to 22 knots.
Speed 220, category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
One of the most popular activities on social media is sharing information and sharing content. It could happen that somebody will post something that then is shared by another user, and so on and so on and so on, until to a point when it can actually go viral. There are some links on Facebook, for example, that could be shared millions of times, and it all starts by one person. Now, this is a phenomenon, and there's actually an amazing story behind it and why we share content. We have this report from Richard Adie.
As we go to air, there's bad news for newspapers in Australia. 69 full-time jobs at Fairfax Papers in the Hunter region of New South Wales are to go. More than half from the flagship Newcastle Herald, the paper which published the child abuse stories that led to the Royal Commission. Staff are in shock. It's a black day. And it underlines the challenges the news media is facing because of technological change. Firstly, revenue loss. The World Wide Web severing the connection between classified advertising and newspapers, then later delivering all that lost revenue and more besides to other businesses, notably Google. The third one, I'll come back to the second in a tick, is happening right now. It's the migration of the audience to the mobile phone. So not the desktop, nor, it seems increasingly clear, the tablet, but to the device most of us have all the time. So I'm glad that Hal Crawford, Andrew Hunter and Domago Filipowicz have had a crack at chronicling what's happened. Together, they make up Share Wars, and they've co-authored All Your Friends Like This, How Social Networks Took Over the News. Hal and Andrew came up with a question. What sort of news content is being shared on social media? To answer it, they needed a tech head. They needed Dom.
The problem for them was they had a whole bunch of theories and you know, thoughts about how what makes something shareable, but they really needed some hard data. And we decided that we needed to build some sort of software and engine that would actually track, you know, stories across the world and store that data so that we can analyze it.
Okay, so talk me through the nature of that challenge, and bear in mind that you are talking to a journalist. Yeah. So
we needed to understand what stories were sharing across the globe. And basically what we did was we started tracking something like 150-odd websites across the globe, all news websites, and tracking each of their stories. And we do this every 20 minutes.
Am I right in thinking that you initially sketched out what you needed to do literally on the back of an envelope?
That's exactly right. So when Hal and I spoke about this first...
Wasn't it a serviette?
Look, it'd be good to nail this down, actually.
And it was quite simple, because this data actually exists already out there. Facebook and Twitter publish this information publicly about what news articles are sharing across the world. And it was just a matter of pulling that together in a way that could be accessible and usable and analyzable.
So the initial idea is that you get the RSS feeds from the news websites and the stats from social media, put them into a database. And you had a huge weekend coding. I love the way you built this all in a weekend. And you come up with the likable engine.
Yeah, so it was one of those inspirational weekends where you had an idea and it just happened. I think that the main part of it was built on the Sunday morning between midnight and 5 a.m. That was an early prototype. I could start actually seeing, you know, that data coming in real time and seeing what was happening in the world, you know, right before my eyes. And that was very exciting. And when I showed it to Hal and Andy the next day, we saw that we had something.
When you first looked at it, you've probably been the only person in the world who would know that information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in some ways, people at Facebook could get access to that information, but there was no publicly accessible way to see that and easily, you know, visualized.
So you run into problems fairly early on with RSS, and you decide that what you're going to do instead is make it a web scraper. Now, this is where I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so basically, RSS feeds are kind of a technical way for seeing what articles are on a website. But really, people are seeing all of their content on the front page of a news site. And that's how Google goes and gets its content. It scrapes the home pages of a website and sees what stories are on there. And that's what we decided to do as a better way than RSS feeds. So we got those stories and then basically tracked how many people were sharing or liking those stories on Twitter and Facebook, which gave us a curve that we could graph and actually see, you know, what stories are spiking and, you know, the audience was reacting to.
And how you were able to get this going, well, Don gets it going, and then you kind of unleash it on the world. And after a while, you come up with four principles for what makes content shareable. Basically, shareable stories, there's overlap, isn't there? But they have one or a combination of four qualities.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to describe them as qualities. Any story can possess all of them or, you know, one or two of them. We call it scent, and it's a combination of marketing knowledge as well as the stuff that we observe from this real data from this engine that Don built. Scent stands for simple, emotional, new, and triggered. And, you know, having done surf life-saving training, I know all these acronyms and they help you and it's kind of naff, but they also help. So simple is the ideal for any news story, which is even the most important stories or often the most important stories are simple.
You grasp them straight away.
Right.
And give me an example of of a simple story that...
Yeah, this one's going to... You're going to think, this is going to reinforce all my views about social media. The archetype of the simple story is a penguin wearing a little jumper. And the penguin wearing a little jumper is the most shared Australian story that we know of to date, shared 600,000 times.
Wow.
Yeah. That is about little penguins down in Phillip Island, and when they get oil on their feathers, they lick it off and they get, you know, they die or whatever. Have to keep them warm, have to stop them from licking their feathers, so you need to knit them little jumpers.
Mm.
The particular article that I'm talking about was an appeal for help to knitters that just went off. So totally simple. But other things that are important, you know, more than the well-being of penguins, changes of government, things like very important political stories that are not just speculation, also fall into this simple category.
All right, what about emotional? Because you actually make the point that a physiological response to a story makes us more likely to share it. And we know that because researchers have found that if you make people jog on a machine and then give them a story, they're more likely to share it than if they just stand there and read it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we did do some brainstorming about how we could get people to do physical exercise and then consume our content. Effectively, though, what you want to do is you want to build in that physiological reaction into the content.
Mm.
A lot of people think, oh, that's me getting angry about something. Mm-hmm. That's true.
I was going to say, shock, outrage, anger, they're the things that come to mind.
They are, but think also of awe. Think about the hairs on the back of your neck raising up. That is a physiological reaction. And if I can get you to feel like that by, say, making you feel very small in the scheme of the universe, then I can get you to share that piece of content.
Mm. All right, so... At the end, in sense, stands for new information.
New. That's so broad. In fact, of course, what we do is the news. It also encompasses this idea of being unexpected. And I think in the book, we give a few examples of the perfectly unexpected story, which is what we call the reverse. The poster child of the reverse is is the baby in Indonesia who smokes two packs of cigarettes a day.
Man Bites Dog is the classic.
Oh, sorry. That is the classic. Yeah. And
You actually, I'm glad we got to the reverse because it's sort of reassuring for the old school journos out there, because the reverse has always been forever a great story, but it still is. And the data shows it. And also there must be a trigger to share the information too. Yeah.
There must be a trigger of some sort. Triggers is, I suppose, where we get closest to the marketing theories of signalling. Triggering is the idea that if something is before you all the time, like breakfast cereal, like disposable coffee cups, they will come to mind more often and therefore you're more likely to share that. How we sort of extrapolate that into news media, I think that's an area we want to explore some more of. Mm. But for example, we already know that things that affect a wide range of people are much more likely to be shared. For example, weather phenomena, things that we see every day, you know, why can't we get public transport to work properly? Stuff like this, if it affects a broad range of people, will tend to be shared.
This is the media report on RN, and interestingly, the word report, Hal's and Dom's research found, is one of the least shared words that there is. How it's not just content. You've also found that there are three distinct classes of shared behaviour. There's newsmaking, which is the one that all journalists kind of understand. This is a story, this is new, here you go. Then there's inspiring and teaming. Hmm. So what's inspiring?
I think of those three categories, and these are basically classifications. So every story will fall into one of these slots, not into two. Newsbreaking, I think we get that.
Mm.
Inspiring is probably what people think instinctively when they think of sharing news on social media, if in fact they do think about it. You know, this kid raised $11,000 selling lemonade on the street corner for his dad's cancer operation. It hits you in the gut. It is like, isn't that amazing? Isn't that an amazing element of human nature that the neighbours of these people would come and give this kid so many thousands of dollars to cure his father's cancer? That kind of thing sits in that inspiring box. And we thought, before we did the analysis, before Dom built his engine, we thought that was the heart and soul of sharing. What we discovered, in fact, was that there was a third category.
And this is teaming.
Teaming. And that is, in fact, the heart and soul of sharing.
Two-thirds of it, yeah, more or less, is teaming. So this is... Yep. What is this? Is this about you saying something about who you are in the world?
That's exactly what it is, and it often involves judgment. So it often involves approval or disapproval.
Right.
In all cases, it involves saying, this is who I am, this is what I believe, this is what I want to be identified with.
So if I'm watching the Swans play, I'm a Swans member, and I'm tweeting about how well we're going, that's part of that.
That is. If you, you know... The Adam Goods, speaking of the Swans, Goods and the whole controversy over the booing of Goods. Mm. If you came out and said, in fact, I don't know if you did tweet on Goods or not, but I would expect you to share a story, for example, Stan Grant's piece, which, you know, I think was quite an amazingly good piece. If you shared that, you would be saying, this is... my camp, this is what I believe in, this is the way that I want to be viewed and the views that I want to propagate through the world. So you are definitely teaming when you share Stan Grant's piece.
Which I did. So there we go. Dom, I want to bring you back in. We've been talking about the likeable engine like it's done and dusted, but I know that these things are always forever iterated. Are you still tweaking it?
Yeah, absolutely. We are continually making updates to it. I think one of the things that we found was its potential as a journalistic tool is something that is very real. And we do actually have people all over the world that are using the Likeable engine. You know, if there's any feedback, we're always interested to find out what kind of things we could improve.
It fits into that emerging ecosystem of getting metrics on this kind of thing. I went to the Guardian Australia's offices a wee while ago and looked at their OFAN system, which gives them real-time feedback on which stories are going well, stories below the fold that seem to be going better than they should be, let's move it up, that kind of thing.
And there are companies making, you know, complete businesses out of this sort of stuff on an ongoing basis. I think when media companies decided to put the like button on all their articles, they kind of lost control to a certain extent of the metrics, and these things are now publicly available and there for everyone to see.
Lost control, Hal. That gets us to, I suppose, the hard questions that you have a look at towards the end of the book. And remember, you're on a program with the word report in its title. Where does it leave us? Because it's easy to think, well, you know, BuzzFeed seems to have this cracked at the moment. Mm. But are we all forever dependent on how well we go on Facebook?
Let's just say yes, we are, but not because it's Facebook. We're forever dependent on it, and we always were. We just didn't realise it. I think is the real insightful take on this. For example, I'm presuming even in the days of hot lead, newspaper editors would have wanted something that their audience valued.
Mm.
They were working in an information vacuum. As the information on your audience becomes exposed and you see what your audience is actually doing, everything changes.
Hal Crawford and Domago Filipowicz are two of the co-authors of All Your Friends Like This, How Social Networks Took Over the News.
Thank you very much, Richard. And it's now time to find out what we can expect propagation-wise and what's been happening. Standing by, all the way in the USA, is our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser. Glenn?
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through September 18th. Fair to poor at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through September 19th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled, shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, the forecast through September 20th, solar activity expected to remain low, with a slight 15% chance for a moderate class flare event. From Peter Coleman of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on September 17th, 18th, 25th, and 30th. Active to disturb September 19th, 23rd, and 24th. Mostly quiet September 20th, 21st, and 29th. Quiet to active September 22nd. Quiet on September 26th to 28th. From SWBC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active on September 20th, 24th, 25th, and from September 30th through October 10th, with minor G1 storm periods likely on October 1st, 6th, and 8th, with A and K indices of 18 and 5, October 5th at 20 and 5, and major storm periods possible October 4th, peaking at 25 and 6. Quietest A and K indices of 5 and 2 on September 22nd, 23rd, and 26th to 29th. Solar flux dropping from 95 September 17th to only 80 on September 28th, back up to 100 by October 9th. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF-DX maps show strong tropospheric ducting September 19th along the coast from North Carolina to Nova Scotia and September 20th from Nova Scotia to Newfoundland. Also strong along the Texas and Louisiana coasts September 21st and 22nd. Extreme ducting over the central Mediterranean September 19th and 20th. And all week all around the Arabian Peninsula as far as India. Also extreme along the southern California coast from September 20th onwards.
All right, thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program as well as past editions anytime by downloading them at our website, pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.